There's an air of vulnerability that comes off you. Why is that?
Say more about that.
Say more about it. Is that one of your fucking psychotherapist questions?
So we are in Phibsborough for this one this week in Dublin. Obviously, we're parked just down the road from the home of this week's guest, James Kavanagh. Now, we were due to speak to James a little down the line in the series, but he ended up inviting us over this week instead because the home we're going to, it's not going to be his home for much longer. Only a matter of days, actually. By the time people hear this, James and his partner William, they'll have moved out of the house and down to their new place in Kilkenny. So it's a huge week for them. So I'm really, really grateful he could fit us in this week. Now, James is someone I've been wanting to speak to for ages, actually. And to be honest, I'm not sure how you would best introduce James Kavanagh. Like, what would you say, Killian? How would you describe him?
He's had one of those careers, Rich, a little bit like yours in one way, that starts off as one thing, then morphs into others, basically. So he first became known through these short, funny videos he started uploading to social media, which usually involved William being put into some state of complete terror in one way or another.
Yeah, there we go.
And then he developed this like huge social media following off the back of that. And now he makes TV series. He and William have a food business. They've written like an award-winning cookbook. So he's kind of a man wearing quite a few hats, I would say.
Yeah, he really is. Now, anyone who follows him will know William too, because he still does feature a lot in James' social media. They've been together, I think, for more than a decade, and it was that aspect of his life that I wanted to find out more about. Like, not necessarily his relationship with William, but more his relationship with his sexuality, because, like, a load of the themes that I'd heard James speak about over the years, identity, sexuality, particularly homophobic bullying, being ostracised at school, like having some really, really difficult teenage years. These are themes I encounter a lot in my work with young people as they're going through it. Like, so to hear an adult, like James would be in his early 30s now, so to hear an adult reflect back on all of that and describe what it was like, but also explain or attempt to explain the impact it had on him, maybe even the impact it continues to have on him, that's the stuff I'm really keen to explore with him.
And I should say, I'm quite curious to hear about the things that made those tricky teenage years a little bit easier for James as well, Richie, because I know one kind of example is that he would have been a member of Belong To, which is this brilliant youth group for LGBT people, young LGBT people, and that's where James would have gone and met other gay people for the very first time in his life, I think, and started to make friends, I think, for the first time in his teenage years as well. So why don't we go inside and speak to James Kavanagh?
Idea of just kind of being in the middle of nowhere and like growing our own food and maybe having chickens.
Very different from here.
Very.
It's a complete shift.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is exactly what you wanted, I read before.
Ready for to become a medieval peasant farmer.
James Kavanagh, you're very welcome to episode.
Thank you so much.
Not once in the lead up to this did you ask me what we were going to talk about.
I know, I just realised that like when I let you in.
You
What's
were like,
happening?
You're like, yes, count me in, with no follow up questions.
Well, I like you and I like what you do, so hopefully
I interpreted that as going, okay, that's the kind of openness that we love here in the podcast, that whatever comes up, you're willing to chat about.
Do you know what? That's the thing. Like, sometimes when I do interviews or whatever, they're always like, is there anything you don't want to talk about? And I'm always like, no, there's kind of nothing
really
I don't talk about. Yeah.
Completely open now.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. We're going to test that now.
Okay. I heard you say once you occasionally speak in schools.
Yes, I do.
Tell us about that.
It's usually around, I'm a gay, in case you didn't realise.
You're not.
This is me coming out now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Exclusive.
Hello, world. Okay. I don't have a wife and two kids. When I was in school, I went to three different schools. The first school was an all-boys school, and that was like mid-2000s kind of era. Things are very different now. And back then I was very badly bullied. I think due to a lot of ignorance, like, you know, when you were describing anything negative, it was like, that's gay, that's gay. Like, the gay thing was always just this negative thing in school. So if you were an actual gay, good luck to you. And I was a gay and I couldn't hide my gayness. So I was quite badly bullied during that period. I didn't have a great start to school at all. I kind of hated it.
So this is early secondary school?
This is early secondary school, yeah. And then I went on to, I was having such a bad time, I was almost coming home and taking it out on my parents. And I was a bit of a recluse, kind of, they'd knock on the door and I'd tell them to go away. Because I guess I was going to school for like X amount of hours a day, getting all this negative, 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 negative. And then I'd go home and I'd be full of all this negativeness and just be kind of miserable. I was a bit of a miserable child, to be honest. It was just me and my computer playing Harry Potter. That was the only time I was ever happy. And then I was sent to boarding school. In a way, I think I was a bit of a problem child. And they were like, we don't know what to do with this boy. So they kind of sent me away. And that was the making of me. It was
so would people have known about the extent of the bullying or the treatment you would have received in those early years?
My parents said, yeah, they did. I didn't tell them about it. In a weird way, I was kind of ashamed of it or something. Because actually, primary school was amazing for me. I was like the most popular kid in the class. I'd always get the main role in the school play. It was a mixed primary school. I thrive in a mixed environment when there's girls and there's boys. I like that mix. Maybe it's another conversation, but I don't believe in segregation when it comes to school. I think mixed schools are the way. And school isn't just academic in my opinion. It's to teach you about life and to prepare you for real life, which is mixed. You're not just with boys or just with girls. So yeah, I came off primary school and I was having a ball and I skipped into secondary school and then was put into a shell, because I think when you're as a gay, when you're like in a school with girls and boys, it almost like the boys won't bully you because you're really popular with the girls. You know that way? It's like, no, he's an asset. So then when I went to boarding school, I was in a mixed school. It was a boy and girl school. And I was really popular with the girls. The girls and the gays, they got on. So I ended up being a bit of a cupid between the boys and the girls. And I think the boys ended up liking me because, I don't know, maybe at the start I was like that, like a bit of an asset to them. But then the boarding school era of my life really made me come into who I am, I guess, today. So anyway, back to your question, I speak in schools. I usually speak in schools around like LGBT week or something like that. A teacher will get me in who maybe follows me and will you give a talk to the class about your own story about bullying and stuff like that, and maybe give some, you know, warning signs for allies, I guess, to look out for, to, you know, be nice to a kid that might be bullied, because it's kind of obvious to see, you notice kids that are being bullied. They're often quiet. They shun any sort of attention.
Like, it's very hard to imagine you as the quiet kid.
Yeah, and it was hard to be the quiet kid because I'm not. I like people and I like interacting with people. And I came from a primary school that was incredibly, you know, like I was incredibly popular with people and I loved chatting to everyone. And as I said, I loved the academic level of primary school because it wasn't like secondary school. It was Tara and Ben go to the shop and they buy two oranges. How many oranges did they buy? Like, that's my level of education. So I had a ball. And then when I had to be this quiet, insular person, like I remember going from class to class, I would bolt because I didn't want to be, when the bell rang, I'd be the first up and first out, so I didn't have to go through the kind of the stampede of people, because that's when you'd get noticed. That's when someone might grab your bag, that's when someone might call you a faggot, that's when someone might push you into a locker. So my whole experience was trying to be invisible.
And are they daily experiences?
Oh, it was daily. Hourly.
Every wander from a class to class in the corridor, you would be subjected to something.
Something, yeah. And when I wasn't, I was anticipating it. So my heart was in my mouth the whole time. And I knew I was gay, but like I obviously didn't want to come out because it was the most negative thing in the world you could be. And I remember even like overhearing other people talking about gay people, and it was always just in a horrible way or a negative way or whatever. So I guess I was just always running around being invisible, trying to be invisible, or anticipating an attack. So it's just like, the anxiety levels are through the roof like the whole time. So yeah, I guess I go in and into schools and speak about that experience. An experience I always bring up is one day in the first school I was in, I think I was in second year, and this one guy who used to bully me all the time, he was kind of my main one. I always think he would be great in like marketing or some creative job, because he was so creative with the bullying. And this was like 2 years in, and he had new ways of bullying me. He used to pass notes around me. He did a survey once, how gay is James, and used a Bic pen like with the four colors to make it look like other people had filled it out. Like, the creativity was mind-blowing. So he was trying to pass this note around, and a guy who I'm still friends with stopped him and was like, here, cop on, like you're doing this too much or something. I can't remember exactly what I said, but it was the first time someone had ever stood up for me. And it was the most energizing thing that ever happened up until that point. I kind of was like, oh, there's actual nice people in the world. And it made the world of difference. So I always kind of say, there's always going to be bullies.
Yeah.
Everywhere. In workplaces, whatever. But you can be the one to stand up for someone else. And that's like, you can't buy that. So that's why I always try and encourage students. Yeah, you're not going to delete the bullies from life, but try and stand up for the one that is getting bullied, because you'll make their life new.
You didn't know your parents knew. Surely teachers would have seen it.
Yeah.
But what was the approach back then?
I think the approach was like, ignore it. Especially if it was like, I don't know, homophobic bullying. It wasn't spoken about. Like, even in sex education, like, it was never addressed.
You got sex education?
Yeah.
What did you get?
It was our science teacher, and he came in one day and he said, right, we're doing sex education. And he was looking at the floor the whole time. And I just remember, like, him being awkward about it made us really awkward about it, and just made the whole thing horrible. And like, it was just like, then they're like, kind of lads in the classroom just couldn't stop laughing, and it was just like this weird thing. So he brought in a video anyway, and it was kind of just like, vagina plus sperm equals baby. Like, that was really the height of it. There was nothing about, like, I don't know, sex for pleasure or like STIs. We didn't learn about anything kind of below the surface, I guess. So it was just this real awkward, like, 40 minute thing. I think he left the class as well while the video was on, and then that was it. That was the only sex education we had.
Any mention of same sex relationships?
None. Absolutely
even,
none.
Even a reference to it?
The only time I ever heard same-sex stuff was in classical studies. Our teacher used to mention same-sex relationships back in ancient Rome or ancient Greece. In English, Oscar Wilde's sexuality was briefly mentioned, which actually kind of pisses me off now, because I'm like, that was such a huge part of his life. There's some people whose sexuality played a massive part in their life, and it's completely brushed over, ignored. Like, you never heard about people like that when you were in school. So no, I didn't really hear any sort of mentions of same-sex couples or anything like that.
So you went into secondary school knowing you were gay?
Yes. No, I kind of discovered it in maybe second year or something.
What was that process?
I always think, like, when you start becoming attracted to humans, it's like either men or women, and I just drifted towards men. But it was, for my family are incredibly liberal. My sister there was always a gay in the house. I have one or two cousins that are gay, so it was never, you know, you hear horror stories of families kind of shunning people or whatever, but no, I never had any sort of issues with my parents, and they kind of, they let me kind of tell them, I guess. They never asked me. And I remember going down, and my mum was watching Coronation Street, and I was like building up for this kind of big moment. And I was like, Mum, I'm gay. And she was like, yeah, we know. Just put back on Rita and Jack from Coronation Street. So none of that was ever an issue. The only issue was my peers, I guess. People my age. Yeah. The fact you felt like the only one in the world. Like, it was mad. I didn't meet other gay people until I was like, I don't know, 16 or something.
So in second year, you're what, 14?
Yeah.
13, 14?
14, 15, yeah.
So you had a couple of years not meeting any gay people, not being in social settings with gay people.
Not meeting friends either. I didn't have any friends back then, like none. Because I guess in my first school anyway, you didn't want to be friends with me because I was gay. And you might be called gay if you were near me or something like that. So I didn't have any friends. And I missed out on that kind of junior, school disco-y type, I don't know, early teens, everyone meeting in Dundrum Town Centre. I'm from Churchtown. So I knew all my classmates were meeting up on the weekends and all that. I never got an invite. Never. I guess even if I did get an invite, there's no way I would have went because some of them would have called me gay or, I would have been a target, or if you like. So I never had that kind of friendship thing until I went to boarding school in fourth year. That's when my life really began.
I work with a lot of teenagers in my therapy practice, and a good chunk of the lads actually I see are grappling with this area of their life and all at different stages, and they experience in all different ways, but it's really common, and it's so heartbreaking to hear that somebody of the age of 14, 15 in front of you, and they're maybe putting words on their experience for the first time, and they might be talking about something that their friends or their family don't know about, and often they'd say something like, but I really wish I wasn't. They might say they're bisexual, they might say they're gay, they might have some term. And then they're like, but I don't want to be this way.
Yeah, I was like that as well. Yeah, I was just wishing it away every night. I remember almost trying to force myself to try and fancy girls. It was just desperate to be one of the lads or one of the other people in my class. Now I couldn't. I'm so thrilled to be who I am. But yeah, it was just desperate not to be myself back then, or, have that part of myself.
Boarding school was great.
So much fun. It was. I remember going down in my dad's car, and I made a decision in my head to, if someone asked me if I was gay, I'd just say it. I was like, this is my chance to have a new leaf, new life, la la la. So I went down, and I was unpacking my bag in the dorm, and one of the guys was like, are you gay? It's such a funny thing, I think, actually. Young straight guys are so obsessed with, I just found this, so obsessed with, gayness as well. They're always asking me. And I was like, yeah. And then he kind of froze. And I'd say he's never gotten a yes answer before. Because if you are gay, usually back then you're hot, trying to hide it. You're trying to say, no, I'm not. Christina Aguilera's a ride. love Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So he was kind of caught off track and confused, and then goes, okay. And then I was to myself, is that all it took just to actually admit it? And then I think they had nothing on me. So there was nothing they could do with that information. I was like, yeah, I am. And then it was just, I got to be who I was. I got to just live and be comfortable. And I had a ball in boarding school.
Really?
Ball, yeah. But I went to Belong To when I was 15, 16. My mum sent me there on a Sunday. I think she was kind of right, get out there and meet other people in your world, and maybe get a bit of an education on gayness or whatever. So I went to how to shop in Brent Thomas now.
how did you feel going to that the first time?
Oh my god, I was so nervous.
I bet.
Yeah, my mum actually phoned them up. And I think she was kind of maybe thinking, oh, he needs to learn about sex education, or maybe something along those lines. And also just to meet other people, because it was just me. And I went down on the Sunday, and I was absolutely terrified. First time I'd ever come across other gays. And it was just really nice. And there was loads of leaflets everywhere about STIs and protecting yourself. And it was just felt really liberal. And there was loads of interesting characters there and other people my age. I think it was about, I was 16 or something. And other people in my positions as well. And the common thread was everyone was being bullied. every other 16-year-old there was in secondary school at the time and was being bullied. So I used to think, I used to go on a Sunday, it was almost like getting charged up for the week, because you'd meet other people and you'd be like, okay, we can do this, we'll get through this. Wow. And
so that's just back then, that was just part of the experience of being gay, was that hand in hand with that meant you were bullied, ostracized.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I have never met another gay my age who didn't go through that. Either the ones that did well were the straight passing ones, if you like, who maybe played rugby, or who maybe, you know, could, who maybe went out with girls and just hid it until they went to college. Like, there's loads of them.
I work with quite a few of them at the moment.
Yeah, I couldn't. I also didn't want to, in a way. I think deep down I didn't want to try and hide that or try and date a girl. Or I remember trying to wish that I could, it would just fade away or something, but yeah. I never forced myself to try, you know, try and kiss girls or whatever. So yeah, it's just part and parcel.
It's an awful thing that you say it so breezily. It's just, yeah, it just comes with the territory.
Yeah. But I think thankfully things are very different now. I know that from going into schools. I'm sure it's not perfect in many ways for different types of LGBT people, but like, you know, the fact there's now these weeks that they celebrate, like that was not at all in my school. I remember a couple of posters went up from Belong To, being like, all right, if you're experiencing, you know, this, or you want to chat to us, belongto.com. It lasted, I think, 20 seconds and they were ripped down. So like now they have full pride flags, full trans flags, like people coming in like me to chat, like none of that. So we are very far from where we were when I was in school. And I know my niece and nephew, they're my like young people litmus tests about like how society's going. And I ask them things and no, things are quite different now. They just left secondary school.
What then is your experiences like? So when you start meeting people or being in relationships or hooking up, like things like that, that most teenagers take for granted, like whatever, kissing someone in a house party or holding hands with someone in the street.
Yeah.
What was that like for you? Because I have friends now who are somewhere between your age and my age. Some of them are married in same-sex relationships, and there's still a little voice in their head, a little supervisor's voice that tells them, don't hold hands.
Yeah.
It's just from years of knowing they shouldn't, whatever that meant. What was that like for you?
I can identify with that. I'm not a PDA person generally. I'm not like the most lovey-dovey person.
Okay.
And me and my brother and sister and my family in general, we joke about it. We always hug each other with like a bit of distance between us and like tap each other on the shoulder. We're not like huggy, lovey-dovey people. So that might play a part in it as well. Okay. But I wouldn't hold William's hand walking down the street, even though maybe it is safe. But I would just, there is that just little voice in my head that if I tune into it, I'm like, okay, that's what's stopping me. But it's like the way like we're innately afraid of like spiders or different colored flowers. Like it's like an instinctual thing. It's like an instinctual thing to me. I also tone myself down if I feel a malevolent presence around me or someone who I deem will maybe shout faggot at me or something like that. Like you become spidey senses when you're gay, I think. It's like a self-preservation thing, I think.
And would friends of yours who are gay, would they describe the same thing?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And then I was even chatting to my friend when we were growing up, we were friends with this other gay who was really camp, like kind of very, very camp. Great crack, etc. But we feel ashamed in a way. We'd almost be embarrassed of them being too gay when we're trying to walk down the street or whatever, because you feel like they're attracting attention to us, and you'd just be worried about your own safety, but like you'd almost be like begging them to like keep it down or whatever. But it was just kind of a safety thing
and can you say that to someone without it being heard as, I'd imagine that would be quite offensive to some people.
Totally.
If I said to you, James, Pat, listen.
Yeah.
Turn it down a notch.
Yeah.
Like I might have nice intentions behind it, but wouldn't be great.
It wouldn't be great to hear it. No, it's been told to me. And like, it's almost like gays when they're in an area or trying to walk somewhere or whatever, you'd be keeping yourselves in check with each other to try and like, you know, blend in a bit better or whatever. So yeah, you have all these like weird instinctual things that, even though I think it's fine now to walk down Grafton Street or walk down wherever and hold hands, it's just this weird instinctual thing that tells you shouldn't do it. Like, I remember like when I was like, when I was in Belong To and I was meeting other gays and I started dating certain people, other people or whatever.
What age did you start dating?
I think like 16.
Okay.
16, yeah. you would never kiss in public. You would never be seen to be romantic in public. It was always behind closed doors. It was, you'd always be looking over your shoulder. It was like you were doing drug dealing or something.
Was that an instinct, or would that be the advice of the people in Blount?
Wasn't advice, no. It was just an instinct thing. It was just, you know, will you get a bottle? Will you get... I remember there was a period, and it melted away a couple of years ago, but I would never go a day without walking through town without faggot being shouted at me. If I was with another gay or with a couple of us or whatever, you'd never not hear faggot from a car or from someone. That hasn't happened now in like years, but that was like from age 16 to maybe 21 or something. Like, that was a given. You'd almost be like, oh, it's coming. Like,
what's, like, you're older now than at that phase of life. Can you explain, like, what is the impact of that? Just walking through your daily life, expecting and always being right with your expectation that someone is going to throw a dig at you in some way.
Do you know what? Like, when I was younger, obviously in secondary school, it was horrible, and it was like heart in your mouth type situation, and just feeling always on edge, like constantly on edge. That's horrible. But I guess from like 16, 17 on, you kind of became, it was like water off a duck's back. It was like, it began to just be nothing. And not that I'm pro-bullying or anything, but like, I think it's kind of almost...
Just to clarify,
it's almost toughened me up. And it would take a lot to affect me now. And I'm not like... I'm kind of almost saying I'm thankful for that growing up. But honestly, it has toughened me up. And I don't get very emotional easy or whatever, because I feel like I've gone through the toughest part. So like, even now, like, because of an online presence or whatever, if I ever get hate or whatever, and people always ask me that if I'm in interviews, oh, did you ever get trolled online? I'm like, that's nothing. Like, a random commenter on my Instagram is nothing compared to what I went through when I was a teenager, you know, that way. So definitely toughened me up.
One of the really distressing elements of my work with younger lads who are on that journey, for lots of reasons, they don't want their friends or their family or the people around them to know that they're gay.
Yeah.
But like everyone of a certain age in their teenage life, they want to have experiences. They want to hook up with people. They want to have sexual experiences. And there are no other gays in the local discos or wherever they're going or whatever house parties. And they go online and they lie about their ages, and they meet with older people, and it's like a recurring theme with so many young people I work with at the moment.
Country people.
They have these really distressing experiences because the person that they're meeting knows they're in the closet, which means this young person is now the most vulnerable, isolated person. And no matter what happens between them, that young person will never speak of it.
Yeah.
And then eventually they find their way into therapy and they might talk about it then.
Yeah.
And it seems to be just so common, maybe is the wrong word, but it is. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very common. And I think like it's down to the fact that like in probably some rural schools and stuff, it's not as popular to have an LGBT week or to invite someone in or whatever than, you know, schools in the more cities and maybe Dublin or Cork, Limerick, whatever. Yeah. But it's just simply down to the fact a large chunk of usually younger gays' lives are robbed, you know, that whole dating, kissing, going to discos, chatting to your friends, like that's a huge part of developing. And I didn't have that. And so many other gays I know didn't have that either. So that leads to going online, as you said, or meeting older people or doing all that sort of stuff, which can maybe have an effect on you in later life. Because, you should be kind of dating people your own age and having that fun experience of... But a lot of it's cloak and dagger. Like, I actually got a message from a 17-year-old in Kerry who was asking me for like tips on like where to meet someone or places to go down in Kerry that he like a kind of belong to type place. And I was just like, it's kind of sad that he's messaging me, someone he doesn't know, that there's no one even in his family maybe that has, maybe could reach out to him, because I don't know, to message someone you don't even know on the internet, I think that's not a great thing.
I think sometimes I hear people talk about these issues and I think we're a bit quick in this country to pat ourselves on the back about how much progress and change has been achieved.
Yeah.
Referendum results. Leo Varadkar, whatever.
Yeah.
But so many young people are in family situations or school or community situations where they just cannot talk about this part of themselves.
Yeah, yeah, a lot. And, it, you know, we judge things too much, I think, on more urban areas and how things are doing in urban areas and cities and stuff. But there's a whole world out there, you know, and it's just important to look out for them as well. And I think a lot of power lies with allies, and a lot of power lies with other people in your school that can maybe reach out to you. Like that guy who stopped that note going around my class, like that was one of the most energizing things that happened at that point. And I remember going into school the next day with a bit of a spring in my step that I had this ally, this guy who looked out for me, and it gave me so much happiness. So yeah, I would say I always try and speak to the allies rather than the gays, because you're the ones that'll make their life more comfortable. Yeah.
The gays know the crack.
Exactly.
They know what they know what's going on.
Yeah.
Another area of yourself you've been open about, your mental health.
Mm.
How is it now?
Really good.
Great.
Yeah. When I was about 25, 26, I had my first panic attack. And up until then, I feel like I escaped like lightly, because I remember like in school there was other people that were definitely going through stuff. Mm-hmm. And even though I was, you know, going through bullying, it wasn't, I didn't really get like depressed about it. It's weird to explain, because I was like, I was annoyed about it, and I was like a problem child. I was taking out my anger, and I think I was maybe like flushing it out on my parents. I'm sorry to them, but I think I didn't like bottle it and maybe do what other kids did, and then it just festered inside. I was kind of erupting it as it happened. I'd flush it out when I went home from school, so I never really got depressed, if you like. I was anxious, I think, but yeah, never really depressed. And I remember seeing other and hearing about other people in my class who were going through something and were going to therapy and all that. So I was like, sailed on till 25, and I was like, grand, I never had any of that. And then I had a panic attack. And then I had many panic attacks, and they kind of, they came on out of nowhere. My life was going well. My boyfriend William, I had a good job, I worked in PR, having a ball in life generally. And I remember I was watching TV one night and I felt this fizzy feeling kind of go up my body. It was like I was in sparkling water. It was or a jacuzzi or something. It was just weird fizzy feeling. My heart started to race and I had to lie on the floor, and I thought I was having a heart attack, and I rang an ambulance, and they kind of coached me down off the edge, and William came home. I was actually on my own. William came home and I didn't know what happened to me. So I went to the doctor the next day and he said, I think you had a panic attack. And then...
Did you know what that was before that day?
No.
Had you heard about it? Had you heard anyone describe what it was like for them when they had one?
I don't even think so. And I think I may have just blocked it out because it wasn't relevant to me or something. And no one... I didn't really have any friends that were going through this either. I wasn't even an anxious person. And yeah, it just came out of nowhere. And it nearly happened most nights for like the next 2 years. Just like, it was like a light switch went off and I had panic attacks every night for about 2 years. And it was exhausting, because a panic attack would drain you. The one I had anyway, it was very, very physical. And then I went on SSRIs. And
how long was it before you chatted to a doctor about it? Did you go see a therapist about it? What was your response?
No, I've never been to a therapist. And I don't know. I think because I went to a doctor and discussed my panic attacks, and I was put on SSRIs. My panic attacks, I actually gave birth to anxiety, I think, because I became anxious about having the panic attack. It's like this weird vicious circle, and the anxiety brought on the panic attack. And I haven't had a panic attack now in, I'd say, about a year okay. or two, maybe. And I'm so thankful, because they were the worst things I have went through, worse than being violently hungover or breaking a bone or something. Yeah, they were pretty bad. So the SSRIs anyway I went on were, I was on 20 milligrams or something like that. I'm now down to 10, with the view of coming off them completely. And I'm doing really good. Yeah, they really changed everything for me. For a while there, I couldn't like leave the house, for example. I only ever left the house if I had a job or I had to. Leaving the house would send me into a panic attack. I remember walking down the road and the noise of the cars, it was a very, it was triggered by a lot of like noise or people or swarms of people or anything like that. So I only left when I needed to. And I kind of, you know, like a real Victorian phrase, I took to the bed.
Yeah.
I did kind of take to the bed for like a year, I guess.
Who knew? How many people knew what you were actually going through?
I didn't like tell Instagram or go on stories or whatever, but I told my parents, told William. Again, this is an openy book thing. I never had issues talking about it. So yeah, I told anyone that was around me. And also to kind of excuse my absence from things, I thought if I was open about my anxiety and stuff, no one would really question me, because I'd even have anxiety about letting someone down about something, and that might even trigger a panic attack. So it was timelines and me are so weird with COVID. I'm like, when was this? But it was a good 2 years of it. Like the horribleness of it. And then I learned to manage it. And I used to do little things, like I'd have a shower and I'd imagine the anxiety washing off me with the water and picture it going down the drain. And like shit like that really helped. I'd have like long periods of like getting ready for bed. I'd light candles. I'd try and do meditation was great, actually. I used to do 10 minutes meditation every night. So I used to do all these things, but I haven't done any of them now in about 2 years, which is great.
Who advised or suggested you do that, or did you go off and research that stuff yourself and come up with those solutions yourself?
Well, when I started to talk to people about, you know, the way I was saying, I knew no one who had anxiety, I knew no one had panic attacks. When I started to say I did, every single person around me was going through something.
It's always the way.
Yeah. I don't know anyone really who hasn't gone through something or hasn't had anxiety or hasn't had a panic attack. I was like, you really? So I picked up tricks from everyone that was going through something or had gone through a period. So yeah, I was collecting little things.
So for people who have never experienced it,
your
description is physically when you're in it, it's horrendous.
Yeah.
And it's not only the experience of being in it, but then there's the constant worry or thought or expectation of when is it going to happen
that was
again.
Worse for me was the anxiety of when am I going to have another panic attack. It was every night, and then it started, you know, three times a week, two times a week. That's how it kind of faded out. But the anxiety of having a panic attack was the worst. I remember I was in London on a press trip, and I was in, it was actually a really gorgeous press trip. I was in the Ritz with Downton Abbey, the cast of Downton Abbey. Yeah. And we were having afternoon tea, and I love Downton Abbey. And I remember building myself up for this, like pleading with myself not to have a panic attack. So I was like, I really want to have afternoon tea in the Ritz. And I was like, please. And I remember sitting down, and that fucking fizzy feeling happened in my feet. And it was a gradual thing going up my legs, burning. And your mom was like, cucumber sandwich. Like it was, and I think it was almost the the panic of being in a room that was very like white gloves and silver. And it was like, this is not somewhere I can have a panic attack. And I went to the bathroom, locked myself in the bathroom for 40 minutes and just had this horrible panic attack. I used to always ring William when I was having a panic attack and he would kind of take me off the ledge. But yeah, it was just the anxiety of having it was honestly worse than the panic attack itself. But it's funny, anytime I had a panic attack, I'd be maybe 50 panic attacks into my journey of panic attacks and I'd still think I was about to die. That was the thing I thought was going to happen. I thought I was going to die. And I never got used to it, or I could never trick myself into being like, James, you've done 50 of these now. Obviously, you're not going to die. And, you know, I'd be inching to the phone to call the ambulance again. I think I called an ambulance maybe three times when it was really bad, but I never thought I wasn't going to die. So it's a very physical thing. But the thing is, I don't know where all this springs from, because I didn't, my life was unreal. Like, my life was really good. As I said, I came out of PR.
Can I just say, there are some things we've talked about in this conversation that didn't sound unreal.
That's true. Yeah. So I have explored that before. I was like, maybe is this deep rooted from when I was younger and it's just raised its head now. So yeah, I don't know where it comes from. It could come from my earlier years, but I don't know. Does stuff raise its head years later in the form of panic attacks? I'm not sure.
When did you first talk publicly about this?
I'd say a year into it happening, I mentioned it and I spoke about it a good few times. And what I liked about speaking about it publicly was all the messages that I got from other people being like, oh my God, I'm going through the exact same thing. It's great to not feel alone when stuff like that's happening. It's kind of like when I think back to when I was a young gayling and thought I was the only one. And then when I started meeting others, it was so nice to not feel alone, you know, that way. In the same way with when you're going through a mental healthy thing, it's great knowing you're not broken.
Even if you don't know the person you've just been contacted by, it is some source of comfort or support comforting. That you go, okay, it's not just me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's so many people. That's the thing. And then I started talking about it more and more on my stories. Every now and then I'd mention stuff about it and mention little ways I managed it. And people found them really helpful and people gave me little tips and stuff like that. So yeah, it was very healing to be able to talk about it, I guess.
Life sounds like it's good for you these days.
Yeah, it is.
You're a world away from your description of you as a 13, 14, 15-year-old who's grappling with loads of different things. And
do you know, I feel most like my primary school James. That's who I feel most connected to. That, like, teenage James is like, I don't know, this weird relation I had. But I feel so, that's who I actually am. I got to actually become that again. But yeah, no, life is great now. And long may it continue.
Long may it continue. It's been great chatting to you.
Yeah,
thanks a million for inviting us into your home. And I really wish you well with everything you've got going on.
Thanks so much.
Cheers, James.
Yeah, nice. Thanks a million, James.
Bye.
Legend, cheers. See you later. Best luck with the move.
Thanks, Mel.
Bye.
I feel the same sitting here as I did after speaking with Donny last week, actually. Like, quite apart from what we were speaking about, you just think, what a likeable fella he is. Like, he's just really good company.
Yes.
I thought he was great on Teenage Dynamics, like that whole world. But the actual impact of homophobia, like what it's like to be the target of it, I think that would be an eye-opener for a load of people. But it was really interesting to hear him, just as Donny did actually, speak about his experiences with panic attacks. Because I know Killian, myself and yourself have spoken about this a lot in the last week. This is something that you've had to manage also, isn't it?
Yeah, and as funny as we were sitting there, something that James said really resonated with me. You know, there's something that he'd never really thought about before because they hadn't been a feature in his own life. And I think when you haven't had a panic attack, like, they're quite a fuzzy, abstract concept. Clearly it's something unpleasant, but, you know, what does it actually mean or entail? And I would have answered very similarly to James if you'd put that question to me up until a few years ago. I had my first panic attack in the summer of 2020. And now on reflection, I can see it was clearly in response to lockdown. So as the first set of restrictions were rolled back, I went to a party that my friend threw in his back garden. And, like, you can just imagine what it was like. So I was 25, and after 3 or 4 months of being cooped up in this really dingy house in Blackrock with really little natural light, it was really cold. We were suddenly, like, with all our friends again. We were, like, you know, I just remember drinking first cold beer under this, like, blazing sun. It was the height of summer. I think it was July. And we're meeting women for the first time in months, and it was honestly just fantastic. And surprise, surprise, we all got a bit ahead of ourselves, and I got really drunk, like, incredibly drunk. And I think piling a huge amount of alcohol on top of a brain and a body that was already hyperstimulated and probably a little bit disorientated after this, you know, sudden hit of social interaction, I think it just sent my system a little haywire, I suppose. And I remember it so clearly. So I was sitting in my garden the next day, again, a beautiful day in the sun, and nothing really triggered it. It was odd. This kind of enormous flush of adrenaline went up through my body. I can still feel it go through me. And with that much adrenaline comes this feeling of pure panic. And that's what a panic attack is in the most basic terms, really. It's like a flooding of your body with excess adrenaline when you don't need it, and your body basically has confused the situation that you're in with one of real danger. So I mean, it may come in handy if you're, you know, suddenly in front of a tiger or a lion, but here it's not particularly helpful. And how I describe it was like, it was like my brain was on fire all of a sudden. It's the maddest feeling, and your body completely seizes up, and the only thing that you can think about is trying to retreat to quote unquote safety. So it's just fight or flight, fight or flight, fight or flight. And I have a really distinct memory of just looking up to the sky on this, again, beautiful summer day and thinking, if whatever this is, because I didn't know, if whatever this is can happen out of the blue, then life will never be the same again. And that was a really, really scary thought. But as I say, as I know now, like, it wasn't out of the blue. Of course, there were reasons for it.
Yeah, that wasn't it for you, though, was it? It wasn't just an isolated incident in those pretty unique set of circumstances.
No, so as I said, it was obviously triggered by, I suppose, that sudden interaction after lockdown and all the booze. But to be honest, after a day or two, I was kind of back to normal. Bar maybe like 15 shaky minutes here or there when I first started going back to crowded places. And I would sometimes be a little bit tensed up if I was hungover, which I often was after the pandemic, because, like, all we wanted to do was, you know, go out with your friends and party and just be with them again. So it clearly was, that experience was definitely at the back of my mind somewhere, something that I hadn't quite figured out or kind of come to terms with. But generally speaking, I was kind of back to normal. Fast forward a couple of years, and the same thing happened again when I was living in France on sabbatical about 18 months ago. It was November 2022. And again, after a big party, and it was the day after this party, and this time I was surrounded by people on the underground, and that was really, really horrible. And I'm looking around at these people, and I knew I couldn't get off, at least for a while. And obviously I got off in the end and kind of calmed down. But unfortunately, because I wasn't working, which was obviously part of the plan, I had nothing but time in my hands and no real distractions. So, like, in the days that followed that, my brain kind of went into overdrive. And I mean, it did what it kind of sees its job as being, really, to protect itself. So, like, my big anxiety about this happening, again, was that it would happen in front of people and I have no way of hiding it, no explanation for, like, why it would be suddenly acting erratically or trying to get out of a place. And so when I went into social situations, my body would just tense up. I'd be super, I mean, jittery isn't even quite the word. I'd avoid eye contact. My palms would start sweating. And, I mean, it's really just your body saying, look, let's get out of here, let's go home, that's safe. So it's a really basic protection mechanism. That's all that is, really. But I say this now with the, you know, the benefit of having gone to therapy about it. At the time, I can't quite highlight how fucking terrifying it is, to be honest. But it took me coming home to Ireland and starting that therapy and learning what was going on internally to start to shed those kind of protection mechanisms, because I was going to French classes at the time. So bar going to those for a couple of hours in the morning, I really started minimizing my social interactions unless, you know, they were happening and I was meeting friends in a situation in the pub or at a party where there's going to be alcohol, because, you know, as with a lot of these things, you have a couple of pints and all of a sudden the symptoms are kind of eased or masked and I'd feel okay. And after a few months of that, my mom and stepdad came to visit me and they were completely unaware of what was going on. It quickly came out because, like, all of a sudden, you know, after months of me kind of hiding myself away, I was, you know, we were out in restaurants, we were going on tours, and I was just in that fight or flight mode, like, all day long. And it's hard to hide that for very long. Especially because I started, during that trip, experiencing a symptom I'd never had before. So one of the symptoms you'll hear along the, like, people mentioning alongside the more common ones, like heart palpitations and stuff like that, is a sense of unreality, is the word my therapist would have used. And it's very hard to get across. It's this kind of very surreal feeling of disconnect where you feel like you're wandering about in a dream, which is obviously really disconcerting. And it really makes you feel like you're going mad. But again, on reflection now, it's just an effect of the adrenaline. But at the time, I didn't know that. So with all this happening, things kind of came to a head on that trip, thankfully. And I spoke to my mum, who, as all Irish mammies would, insisted I come home for a couple of weeks and started therapy, which I did, thank God. And once I started seeing a therapist, I made a massive leap forward really, really quickly. And now I'd say I'm only really kind of a few percent off where I was before that panic attack in France.
Great.
Now, I do want to say this, because if I was listening to this podcast in the state I was in, I'd be like, Jesus, that's a long amount of time. And it is, but it was only that long really because of me being a stubborn, pig-headed fucking Irish male, because one of the things that really kept the symptoms going was drinking coffee, because just, you know, the amount of caffeine in it, and it made me jittery and on edge, and I stupidly kept drinking it because I love it. And I'd be like, tomorrow it won't happen. But I've switched to tea now, and that's kind of been one of the final hurdles, really, hilariously. So, and I should also say, again, if anyone is going through something similar, like, the vast majority of people statistically will never have this. And I think really comfortingly for people who maybe had one for the first time, the amount of people that will, you know, go on to do it repeatedly and kind of develop a panic disorder is really, really small. So that's great news. So, yeah, it's funny on reflection, having spoken about it and come through it, it was very unpleasant at the time, but it's been a very interesting road now.
Yeah, do you know what? I'm listening to you now, and I think one of the things that this shows is, like, the impact of people speaking openly about their own stuff, like, whatever it may be, and whether it's publicly, privately, whatever, when they're comfortable to do so, obviously, there's always a ripple effect. Like, because Donny and James spoke, you're now speaking. And I also had the really lovely experience during the week, actually, when one of my closest friends, having heard Donny speak last week, spoke to myself and Fiona for the first time about something that she'd been going through. And she said she wouldn't have done it if she hadn't heard Donny say some of what he said last week. Like, which is great. Like, it was lovely, actually. Right, we'll leave it there for this week's show. I want to say a huge thanks to James again. I really did love chatting with him. He'll have moved house by the time this goes out, so I really wish himself and William well with all of that. Thanks to you, Killian.
Thank you, Richie.
And thanks for listening. Episode is a Second Captains production and is part of the Acast Creator Network.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.